In your time, the world was divided by great wealth and extreme poverty, overwork and unemployment. The global economy was falling apart. We were accelerating towards the cliff edge of catastrophic climate change, and our oil-addicted economies grew much more expensive and harder to get hold of.
Two Degrees, a festival between art and action. Climate, consumerism, community, 17th to 22nd of June 2013. With Louis Bassett, Andrea Franke, Platform, Amy Shoddox, Tom Shivers, and more. 2 Degrees.
So this is the third festival. We do it every 2 years. We try to find interesting projects which connect in the kind of wider subject of climate. And it's one thing we say in our brochure, we say like every time we talk about it in public, that we want to approach climate with a broad view. For us, like, you shouldn't just look at an ecological or environmental system. You shouldn't just look at what is causing and the effects of climate change. You have to see it in a broader scale. And that's also connected to the fact that we want to try and look at opposition to existing systems and solutions and how we can change and recreate things in the future. So then you really have to look at everything across society.
Last night I was reading Rudy the story of Winnie the Pooh and the Honey Pot. You know what happened? Stuck his nose in the pot once too often, and he got stuck.
If these people lose their jobs, they got nowhere to go. My father has worked there for 24 years. I gave him my word.
It's all about bucks, kid. We make the rules, pal. The news, war, peace, famine, upheaval, the price of a paperclip. We pick that rabbit out of the hat while everybody sits out there wondering how the hell we did it. Now, you're not naive enough to think we're living in a democracy, are you, buddy? It's the free market.
So World Shark is a daily reading group of the Financial Times. In the Gherkin, in the cafe at the bottom of the Gherkin, each morning kind of work out exactly what this paper is about. We want to give ourselves back a sense of agency over kind of what's happening and kind of understand these kind of financial mechanisms and these kind of games, essentially, that are set up to kind of play us and to keep maintain that distance.
OK, we jump through quite a lot, but this one's a good one, the BT chief, because it just really sums up how the whole thing of us living in a... you know, electing our politicians and whatnot is absolute nonsense. It's basically about how this young guy, I think you mentioned it before, he's basically Cameron sat down clinched a deal over a 30-minute chat and a cup of tea. He's made this guy the minister for, what's he made him minister for? Trade, yeah. Basically, you know, he's done well at British Telecom. He's put the price of shares in British Telecom. He's multiplied that about 3.5 times. So they've put him into government, which is, you know, and this is like Tony Blair's leftover from where it was all like, you know, it's really corrupt having the House of Lords as inherited things. But this is how it now is. You know, it's even more corrupt. It's like literally just Cameron likes you. Yeah, you get in for the half-hour cup of tea. That's it. You're settled down. You're Lord so-and-so. You're running trade and industry and your establishment, you know. And, our elections are a joke. That's what that headline is to me.
So, yeah, it's been really good. It really depends on who comes for breakfast. On Tuesday, we had a guy called Brett Scott, who is really worth checking out. He was a broker working in Mayfair. In a way, kind of undercover. He always had kind of activist, kind of critical awareness, and then wrote a book, or has just written a book that's just been published called The Heretic's Guide to Finance, and really, really worth a read. He was so clear in explaining some of the kind of complicated terms you come across in the FT, and just really interesting again. And then on Monday, we're joined with an economist from who teaches at London Met. Actually, he's been coming quite regularly, a guy called William Dixon, and really, really appreciate his input again as well. Today we had Max Kaiser, who has his particular like perspective on things, but he's a really useful guy. Obviously, he's worked on Wall Street. He's done interesting things with finance, and he has a really strong position on stuff.
The average American financier has a God complex, which is part of the problem. They feel they are omniscient and no law touches them, and they know better than you.
And they're kind of right.
Well, you see what's happening all around the world. People are rising up against banker occupation, whether it's Brazil, Greece, Ireland, the UK at some point will wake up to this fact. The poll tax rise were nothing.
What's the solution then?
No, I came on Monday, found it really fascinating, because I think one of the reasons why the bankers get away with it is that it's sort of like a different world. We don't understand, we're meant not to understand what they're doing. And I think this thing with debt is fantastic. I don't know if you know the Hogarth painting, The Rake's Progress, but that's about debt. And he was put in the debtor's prison. And the illegality of debt was only lifted in 1904. So it's less than 110 years ago, individuals who had however little a debt ended up in prison.
Well, the Deloitte Touche is one of, I guess, the remaining four of the big four accounting firms. And they're as crooked as the banks are in all of this. Remember, Arthur Andersen was Enron's accountant, and they signed off on their books. Complete fraud. So they're part of the problem. The accounting agencies are crooked. They've been caught breaking the law. The rating agencies are extremely crooked. They're caught breaking the law. The fund managers, the banksters, the politicians, they're all compliant in what you could call a racket. It should be approached as a racketeering, using anti-racketeering laws, the way that organized crime is prosecuted. The problem is, as was mentioned in this report from the government this week, they use what was described in this report as the Murder on the Orient Express defense, which is a very nice way to say that it's an organized racket, because nobody is saying that they're responsible. Now, again, you would not read that in a U.S. paper. They would not describe it as such, in such genteel manner.
How would they write it then?
These thugs were caught in a racket, period. There's blood in the streets, period. Buy gold.
Noam Chomsky is like kind of known for saying that if you really want to understand the news, read it in the financial papers. And to some extent, our world is constructed by like economics, or like everything like that kind of happens in economics really affects us. And particularly in finance, it's kind of an exclusive kind of terrain in which there's not necessarily a direct entry for people who are not familiar with the language, not familiar with the system's workings, to be involved, right? So it's kind of exclusive. I mean, even the cost of the newspaper is £2.50. So for me, it's kind of it's about learning how that system operates, not necessarily to allow myself to function as an individual in that system, but know strategically as an activist where I can make kind of entry points into that. Yeah, I feel like I've personally learned loads.
It's an immersive, site-specific theatre piece, which six audience members only can go on per time. And the performances take place while the city is most alive, so at 9 a.m, 1 p.m. and 5 p.m. daily during weekdays, so this past week and this coming week. And really, Oil City comes out of a whole set of work that Platform has done over the years looking at the finance of the fossil fuel industry. And we wanted to kind of create a work that built on our previous audio tours, both of the City of London and of the Tate Galleries. And we wanted to make something that was, something kind of experiential. So it took the audience inside the space of the city, kind of undercover, in order to sort of kind of look at it anew, look at it afresh and raise questions about, well, what's going on in there, and kind of get to the heart of the things that are going on in there. And so from our research, we know full well that the UK banks are some of the biggest financiers of tar sands in Alberta. So this is one of the most horrific, devastating and ecologically destructive projects on Earth, which numerous First Nations groups across Canada, but largely in Alberta, are all challenging in the courts or protesting in the streets. And so having been involved in different campaigns at Platform around that, we wanted to focus on that in this piece.
I came a long way to be here today. If this is the one chance I get, I'll take it.
Look, this is a situation. There's something dodgy going on here. Has to be.
I really don't want to be named. We can't let this get out of hand. Get me everything you can on them. This is where they signed it. This is where they signed the deal. The thing is when these deals first came through, 10 years back, we thought it was a good thing. I mean, First Nations people, we had already lost so many rights to the Canadian government that earning some money back off them, it just seemed like the only independence going. I wanted to be near my family, so I worked in these tar sands myself for a couple years back when I was 19. I know, can you imagine me in a boiler suit and a hard hat? I mean, I made it work, but there was nothing like as many jobs as they promised. There's arsenic and mercury in the rivers now. Both poisons. We have these deformed fish, just like the folks in Louisiana after the BP spills there. But our waters are contaminated not only by the spills, but by this everyday process of producing some type of oil from these tar sands. One of these toxic tailing ponds leaked into the Athabasca River just last month. And that is where people drink from. And then it gets from there into the moose meat. And that is a staple food for a lot of folks in Fort Chip. Cancer rates amongst our community have soared. People just keep getting all kinds of sick. It scares me, it does. I mean, my grandmother. See, and it's sacred water too. All water is sacred. We are a spiritual peoples, and this is a spiritual fight we're taking on.
People who just do stuff around the tar sands to resist the tar sands in Canada are coming from, if the tar sands were fully exploited, then that would mean total climate tipping point, no way back, and that's one way of looking at it. But actually also the way of looking at it is like there are treaty rights that were signed by Queen Victoria of England that are totally being broken by these projects going ahead. And so like, let's try and take that to the courts. It's like, you kind of see with all these issues, there's always that intersection going on between issues of race and racism, issues of, poverty and, issues of Indigenous land rights that all are wrapped up with something that other people might look at as a climate-based issue when actually it's much more complex and there's all these different standpoints to start fighting and resisting those positions from, yeah.
The other thing that we've been working on is with an artist called Kamala Katbamna, who has kind of done a call out for people who live or work or commute within a mile radius of the city and Arts Admin's home, Toynbee Studios. So we're working with between 20 to 30 people who have a kind of stake in that area, whether it's through working in the city, whether it's living in Tower Hamlets, whether it's going to the pubs in the area, whatever. Those people have come together and are forming a choir called Change the Record. And that choir have been meeting every week for the last 2 months, and they're going to be kind of doing a kind of promenade performance. Also, their repertoire is made up of songs that they find important to the areas in which they live or work.
When My name is Barbara Vesey. I'm originally from New York, but I've lived in the UK for 25 years. I work as an archivist and assistant librarian at the Bishopsgate Institute on Bishopsgate. And I've only been working there about a year or so. I've been in London for about 18 months. Before that, I was living up north in Sheffield. I chose Joe Hill because I first heard it when I was about 8 or 9. My older sister had the album of Woodstock. I grew up in New York, and Woodstock happened upstate, and somehow she felt part of it. I guess she was 16, and I was 8. And so she'd bought the album. I think we went to see the movie, actually, even at the cinema. And Joan Baez sang it there famously for her husband, who was at that point in prison for refusing to go to Vietnam. Basically, he was a draft dodger, as they called them. And she said it was her husband David's favorite song. And somehow it just really stayed with me. And it was such a simple melody, I suppose. And I mean, strange things happen. Sort of fast forward, you know, 20 years or so, when I was having my daughter Hannah and my son Joe, and you're sitting there at 3 o'clock in the morning and you're trying to think of a lullaby, and all kinds of strange things come into your head, and that came into my head. So I just started singing it to them, and that was funny too, because when Hannah was about 2, we were in the supermarket and she was singing bits of it, and one of the lines is, "I never died, said he," and the looks that she got. This is a tiny child singing about death. But anyway, and they both say that they remember that song and that it means something to them. And it was my little indoctrination of them into the ways of socialism. I didn't know until recently Joe Hill was, yeah, a real person. Well, I knew he was a real person, but apparently he also wrote songs himself. But he was a union activist, and he was wrongfully accused of killing someone. And hanged for it. He was shot, obviously, for it, out in Utah, I think. But anyway, yeah, it means a lot to me that you can hear us warming up there, and I should go do that with them, I suppose. But yeah, is that everything? Oh, and my connection with the area is, yeah, working at the Bishopsgate and seeing a lot of people come in to the library who are maybe homeless or. And we, you know, they can sit there in the quiet and enjoy it. And so there's that. And then right opposite the street, there's like huge RBS building. And we have a sort of canteen on site that they all use. It's incredibly expensive. Nobody who actually works at the Bishopsgate uses the Bishopsgate kitchen. But so it's this really strange contrast. And I don't know what's going to happen in the future. But to me, that's something that kind of sums up the city, is that these differences, and hopefully, you know, things will change for the better.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, said he. Alive as you and me, says I. 10 years dead. I never died, said he. I never died, said he.
Okay, that's pretty good, pretty good. Yes, that was good. We'll work on that. That's really good. So that's the first time we've got through.
And so we've also got Andrea Frank in the studio with us. How do you pronounce your project? Is it Read, Talk, and Make? Read, Talk, Make, okay. Is it a community project or an artwork? It seems to be fall somewhere in between the two.
Yeah, I think a place in between the two is a good place for me. We thought it would be really interesting to create in a city or in a community or in a building a space where people could go and make things. And there have been some maker spaces recently, but most of them involve big machinery and they involve lots of investment, and we wanted to do something quite small that could be a model that other communities could copy. So we found this community that was really open to the idea and wanted to test it. The only thing is they didn't have the space to do it, which proves the point of this problem in cities. So we ended up creating a tool library and a cabinet of tools that people can borrow it and they can use outside space when it's sunny. But in the last 2 months, I think we've been actually doing things in the foyer of the of this council state, St. George State, and which is really incredible because then we've been working outside and people are coming by and passing, and it has slowly build up all this interest and people want to do different things and they have different ideas of what to do. So what's happening now is next week we have an open day on the 21st of June on the Friday, and we're hosting a discussion from 12 to 2, and we're going to try to get together the Resident Association but also the Housing Association and try to decide. There's many people in the state that have ideas of how to take it forward.
Well, I popped along to Stockholm House and I saw a group of children and differing aged adults sort of coming together to make things and create things, which I just thought was wonderful. They were making toys, bits of furniture, and apparently today, or later today at the Maker's Market, they're going to be building a house, which I think is something everybody is looking forward to. Well, yeah, we all need housing, don't we? So, I think that inspires people to look at the different opportunities there are and perhaps different things that they can do with their lives.
Is your child involved as well?
Not yet. And I think I'm going to pick up my daughter from school at 3:30 and hopefully we'll have the time to get back here and enjoy it and be part of it.
Well, there's a few of us have been interested in Wellclose Square having some life on it. It's a conservation area. It used to be a Georgian square. It was the centre of the Danish community, and it was taken down at the end of the 60s, and a market on the square seems like a really good opportunity to bring life back to the neighbourhood and in a way celebrate the community that was here with and communities that have always been here with somewhere where different people in the area can meet, and a market is a very good way of doing that.
And there's two parallel ideas seem to be going on today. One is also about a kind of maker space. What do you think about that project?
I think it's an excellent project. They can work together in that you have spaces in car parks. There's a podium here. There's a car park underneath it. There are some spaces in there. There's an old boiler room that could be used as workshops for people selling stuff on the market here. And the market might be things which are products, art, technology, performance, which are made in the area that then come to this square, and there's an outlet for people who are involved in making things. And I think there may be slightly different scales being discussed here, but I think a market that has these things of different scale can be very successful.
Basically, I run the adventure playgrounds, and they come in and use the adventure playground as a play, because it's free play, free choice, you know, for local children and for children that come from all over, come and use the playground, and we don't charge anything for them to use it. They come, they do den building, they make fires, they cook on a fire, we do like healthy eating, you know, we do a bike project where we fix their bikes and stuff like that. So there's quite a lot of stuff. But like I said, we're based down the other end of Cable Street, near the other East End Home Estate. You know, we're sort of about keeping the children off the streets, really, and getting them to come into the playground rather than, you know.
But there's nothing like that on this estate.
Well, this estate here. They have a little session, I think it's on. Not sure, is it
Fridays.
Tuesday? Is it Friday?
Well, there was one, it got stopped because its funding got cut, but there was
no, but she's back on it now, Eleanor.
Is she?
Yeah.
Is it Tuesdays now?
I think it's Tuesdays. They come and they bring loads of play resources and get the children out of the flats to come and play on the green area, whatever green area is left. You know, I know they can go out and play in the park, but sometimes in the park you get like older children, you know, sitting there smoking and drinking and stuff like that, and, you know, it's not ideal, is it, for some of the... So it's just nice to have play workers around.
East End Homes, you can see, are just kind of carrying out a lot of improvements and refurbishment on the estate. I think I can say that, you know, in principle, we would be more than happy to support something here, but it'll be a matter of convincing housing management that what you want to do is going to be self-sustaining. And if we can facilitate that in some way or another, happy to do so.
Okay, so today we sort of tried to get a group of people together for a lunch to really discuss what plans were in place already for St George's Estate in Shadwell, and looking at bringing together people who make things in the area. So we've been working for the last 2 months with loads of different kids groups and adults to look at making, and in the kind of broadest sense, but a lot based in kind of 70s self-sufficiency kind of models. Anyhow, so from this, we've kind of decided to have an open day to really see what happens next with the project. And I think what we're really interested in is a lot of the spaces that are in flux that used to be underground car parks, of what they could be. Could they be an artist studio? Could that kind of develop the projects that we've been sort of kick-started through 2 Degrees?
I think this has been really interesting because we arrived with a plan that had to change completely on an everyday basis. So we wanted to build a maker space. We wanted to have a room, have some tools, and maybe a few workshops, and then leave this working maker space for the state. And then there wasn't a space, so we ended up building a tool library by the suggestion of Linda Standing, which works for East End Homes, and then doing these workshops to activate it. And instead of adults, we had loads of children coming to the workshops, and they kind of completely took over the whole activating part of the project. So that was quite different from what we expected. And then we met John Bell and Genia, and they mentioned this idea of a maker's market. So we thought that was a very interesting connection. So now we're doing this launch of the idea, the potential of the well-closed square market. And the whole meeting we had today was about how to organize in and make this market happen, and how could a maker space relate to that. So I'm very happy. It's a very good meeting.
The end day, which I referred to in passing, is a day called Imagine the Great Transition. That day's happened because we are part of a European network of performing arts organisations who want to work on climate change. And together as a network, we approached the New Economics Foundation, and actually specifically Andrew Sims, who's a fellow of NEF, to engage with a report they produced in 2009 called The Great Transition, which they're supporting through an ongoing campaign. The reason why we did that is all of these European organisations are producing performing arts projects about climate, and we've all found ourselves moving to working to think about wider ecological and social justice issues while addressing them. And so a vision like The Great Transition report that looks at a kind of way of moving to a more just future while also dealing with the kind of our ecological impact is something really interesting. So we choose to engage with that report in a day. So there's a mixture of kind of talks and discussions and artist projects, some of which are directly is responses to or engaging with that report and the thinking of the New Economics Foundation.
I think it's great getting kind of artists and activists together. So chatting with Sarah just this morning, she was talking about how you get great movements of people sort of independently going in a different direction. She was talking about kind of wing beats and flocks of birds. And again, this sort of notion of a kind of a murmuration of artists and activists flying to a better world seems like a very, very nice thought. So I thought I'd play fantasy economics. I thought I'd ask the question, what kind of country would I like to live in? And I thought I'd give this country a name, and I'll call it Goodland. And this is where the fantasy economics kicks in. So in my Goodland, and this is just a sort of my thumbnail version, I will start by having a sort of a people's president who lives in voluntary simplicity, setting a demonstrative example. I'll have a constitution which is drafted by citizens. I'll have communities democratically deciding on their local spending priorities. I'll have finance subordinated to serve the useful economy and public purpose. And I'll have a helpful and largely mutually owned, secure, local banking infrastructure. And bankers who screw up big time, instead of getting bonuses, would get punished. I'm going to have green cities that grow a good amount of their own food, an affordable, healthy, tasty food. I'm going to plan the rapid, near total decarbonisation of the economy to avoid catastrophic climate change. Not at all ambitious. I'm going to protect our life-supporting ecosystems by giving them legal priority, have economic statistics that measure things that matter. I'll have a national plan for well-being and good living. We'll all have the option of a four-day week. There will be progressive taxation with free education and healthcare and affordable care for children and the elderly. And our corporate sector will be characterised by cooperatives that do not operate on a beggar-thy-neighbour principle. Now, that's just my list. It's a quick one. You can make up your own. It is, of course, hopelessly, hopelessly, hopelessly utopian. Or is it?
Now, as we began with a dirty limerick, we're going to end with a collective sing-song. I'll sing the main line, and you sing the answer, okay? Now, the answer is, of course we freaking can. Everybody,
of course we freaking can.
Okay, good. Now, this is the song, and then you come in with the line. You'll get the tune, I hope. It's okay. Can we make the great transition? Can we make the great transition? Can we make the great transition?
Pandemic spreads. A terrorist detonates a nuclear bomb in a major city and claims to have more ready to explode. Ice caps melt. Coastlines are submerged and crops wither from drought. Clean, fresh water becomes increasingly difficult to obtain. Or maybe it is oil that becomes scarce, or a global financial panic erupts that regulators cannot contain. Sound familiar? Any one of these scenarios could occur in our lifetimes. The one thing they all have in common is that their occurrence will touch off panic, and in some cases, hysteria. As a result, these events will also contain the seeds of profit for investors who stay calm and think rather than panic and run. Now, where do you think I found those words? Ladies and gentlemen, I found those words in The Wall Street Journal Guide to Investing in the Apocalypse. It is a real publication written by apparently real people and published, not you might think, before evidence of our current economic model imploding, but in 2011. It seems we have gone not very far from when the architect of modern finance-driven globalization, Alan Greenspan, on and off for 20 years, head of the Federal Reserve, famously said, "I found a flaw in the model that I perceived is the critical functioning structure that defines how the world works, so to speak." He added those words at the end. This was in front of a congressional committee. So I've screwed up in a bigger way than it is possible to imagine, so to speak. You know, it's a bit like, you know, if you went to the doctor and got a really, really bad prognosis, and he said, "You've got 24 hours to live, so to speak." And we turn around, and what do we see? We see our international financial institutions, we see our politicians telling us that there is nothing more important than getting back to business as usual. We hear the IMF predicting that we'll globally be back to growth at about 3.25% next year, which would mean the global economy doubled over the course of the next 20 years, locked into a logic of ever-increasing growth. Anyway, with that, we want to, in the most sustainable imaginable way, mine your imaginations and intellects for how we might have these positive preparations in advance of the next crisis. And I have just one question I'd like to kind of throw open to people, just intrigued to know, that because there have been, in the last decade, a few occasions where the order and sort of social and economic structures around us have come perilously close to falling apart. It was just over a decade ago that it was said, when the road hauliers had blockaded fuel depots around Britain, and you had the chief execs of the big supermarkets in Whitehall saying that they basically had 3 days' worth of food left on the shelves. You know, we were, in effect, nine meals from anarchy. And in 2008, we were within hours of people not being able to get cash out of ATMs anymore. And I just wonder, if those circumstances came around and you suddenly found that you couldn't get money out of the wall anymore and that the supermarkets were empty, what would you do? What would you do?
I think it's important to acknowledge that there is a crisis. It's not coming, it's happening. And the crisis is not affecting most people in this room. It's affecting the poor and the marginalised. So we have a moral responsibility to help those people if they want it. Because we're going to be fine in this room. Let's be realistic about it.
I'm coming from Latvia, from Riga. Maybe you know, it's a country who had the best austerity program.
Allegedly, yes.
And actually, we experienced this situation when people have cannot draw out money, because I think it was last year, one bank kind of was closed. And then this made people very scared, actually, and there were long lines at these bank machines, because they were told that you can take out from another, like, state-run bank a certain amount of money, and when you cannot use your card anymore, you cannot go to the shop. And so it was really very strange feeling, and having those long lines of people standing just to have some money to do a normal. And then what started was this what we were talking here about, just to conversations between people and how to what is this, how to deal Yeah, and it, I think it's really an interesting question. What happens then?
I think what the fuel crisis showed, and you know, the fuel crisis, the shutdown. Let's be clear about it, the blackmail from the hauliers was that if you don't comply, you will pay the price. So I guess if I was planning ahead for the next crisis, I think my ambition would be to look for how do you break up the relationships between the powerful institutions so that that kind of influence can't be wielded quite as strongly as it currently is. And I'll give an example based on something Danny said, which is Liberate Tate or Art Not Oil is part of the power of the oil companies comes not from just their economic power, but because of their relationships to the institutions of the great and the good. So I would think if we're planning for the next crisis, one of the first things you could do is make sure that the South Bank doesn't take money from Shell, not just ends their relationship, but is clear about why they're ending their relationship. Because once those institutional bonds start to weaken, the power of to use them for blackmail, I think, also weakens. It's a low price tag. You know, that's not a big ambition in terms of money. But it does require artists who participate and who love those organizations to say, we love you so much, just again as Liberate Tate says, we love you so much that we want you to separate yourselves from your very own toxic assets.
The first step on our journey, obviously, was to do a Google search. What will
my mortgage payments be?
What will my baby look like?
What will the iPhone 5 have?
What will we do in heaven?
What will be.
We seem to have stumbled across the story of modern Western life.
John Shah says that the future isn't somewhere we're going, but something we're creating, and that's what the piece asks the audience to engage with.
So are we resigned to looking out across the future, shrugging our shoulders as if to say, well, the future's not ours to see? What will be, will
be. It's a mix of performance, stand-up comedy, classic game show-style games, and clips of filmed interviews with current important thinkers.
To be a great scientist, you have to be a very humble person, really. Looking at the greatness and the complication, that puts things in perspective in a way that helps us, I think, to begin to look at the values and things that are important and things that aren't important.
Try and understand yourself. Give some time to reflection. Serious reflection about who you are, what should you value, not what do you value.
I think it's incredibly important to inspire people with a vision of what life could be. The more that we can send postcards from the future, if you like, that talk about a really positive, fun way of living, then I think we'll motivate people alongside all of the very real warnings we also have to give about what happens if we carry on our current path.
The Roadless Trip uses personal story and also collective endeavour to enable us to start creating the sort of future that we all want to see.
Iceland's got something quite funky going on at the moment after their economy imploded. They've got a crowdsourced constitutional reform process going on where the founding principles were developed by a randomly selected group of citizens. Over half the electorate took part, guided by a constitutional council. They took the view that entrenched political and business elites and foreign ownership of assets were to blame. And they had the intention of avoiding future disaster and to limit the powers of those who caused the last one. This is currently hanging in the balance. It requires the support of 2/3 of their MPs and 40% of the electorate to become law. But watch that space. Now, what about those banks that actually do something useful? Well, oddly, there's this little economic backwater that you may not have heard of. It's called Germany. In Germany, 70% of the banking sector is in small or community banks. They have a dual bottom line in which they have to be useful as well as profitable and actually lend to small businesses. They're mutually owned. They have local branch decision-making and autonomy and a lot of local knowledge. They're not allowed to get involved in really risky investments. And in Sweden, there's this bank which has recently come to Britain called Handelsbanken. It doesn't pay bonuses at all. Now, about subordinating finance to public purpose, well, there we have to hop back to our northern neighbours, Iceland, again, who after the crisis forced the creditors to take the hit rather than the taxpayers. They used capital controls, created new public banks from the wreckage of private lenders. They have multiple criminal proceedings underway against those responsible for the crisis and began that new constitutional experiment. Paul Krugman, Nobel Prize winning economist, said this of Iceland. He said, a funny thing happened on the way to economic Armageddon. Iceland's very desperation made conventional behaviour impossible, freeing the nation to break the rules. Where everyone else bailed out the bankers and made the public pay the price, Iceland let the banks go bust and actually expanded its social safety net. Where everyone else was fixated on trying to placate international investors, Iceland imposed temporary controls on the movement of capital to give itself room to manoeuvre. Now, you walk around London at the moment, and notwithstanding there are one or two quite nice little things going on with our city farms and all the rest of it, there's also far too much stuff being carpet-bombed with new glass and steel developments. But if you want that vision of green cities, Cuba's organic urban farming revolution is quite remarkable. It was driven by necessity at the end of the Cold War, where they lost access to cheap Soviet oil imports. But in the period of just a few years, you ended up with a situation where half the food consumed in Havana was grown in the city's own gardens. And urban gardens provide 60% of the vegetables eaten in Cuba. And as a consequence of that, all dietary-related illnesses plummeted. People were eating less, but they were eating healthier. Because there was less fossil fuel-driven transport going around, people were walking and cycling. An unintended consequence of massive urban greening, driven by the kind of thing that in a few years' time, the way the price of oil is going to go, inevitably you saw a revolution in an urban environment.
Credit card overdraft.
So several things at once. Yeah. Okay, so we've got a financial debt here, and what's the sort of scope of that?
It's not terrible,
yeah.
But it's big enough.
So I'm gonna put
big enough to say that I'm blacklisted in most parts of Europe.
Right. So I'm gonna put that I'll put that as inverted commas, big enough to be blacklisted.
Yeah.
Great.
I've been doing highly unqualified debt counselling off and on for the last 2 years. Yeah.
As a whole, the sample that you've seen today.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. Would you draw any general conclusions?
Generally, a surprising number of very large mortgages in the demographic that's come to this session today, larger than in some previous. A great deal of sort of vague and amorphous senses of environmental obligation. So it's just a sort of sense of general need to do something. So we've been trying to help quantify that. And lots of people feeling that they need to, that they owe time to their families and to themselves. Lots of worry about amount of time. Mm. Those being the major debts that people have racked up.
Is this just drawing these things out from people, or do you have advice about how people might address these issues as well?
Mm. Well, being a highly unqualified debt counselling service, the approach we usually take is reflective, so that rather than offering specific concrete advice just from me, we might try and work out together with the client what they might do. Yeah, yeah.
Feeling more anxious than when I came
more
in.
Anxious.
Yeah.
That's quite common, so don't worry about that too much. We're going to try and break that mountain down into small, manageable chunks.
Okay.
If the mountain were not a mountain but a monster, what sort of monster would it be?
I don't know. Mm.
Would it be a dragon, for example?
Oh, I see what you mean.
Or a manticore, a bit smaller there.
A bit more like a manticore.
Is it the same size as a manticore, bigger, smaller?
It's a similar shape, but it's a bit bigger.
Bit bigger than a manticore.
Yeah.
So maybe a rhino-sized. That's the size of a lion, obviously.
Okay, I thought that was to scale.
No, that's not to scale. No.
Okay, no, about as big as a rhino. I see.
Man, tail of a scorpion.
Yeah, it's a rhino-sized manticore.
Rhino, so it is actually a manticore, but it's extra.
It's extra large. Extra large.
Okay, rhino, and what sort of mood is it in?
I wouldn't say it's angry.
Yeah.
But it's
irritated.
It's irritated.
Brackets. Irritated. Lovely. Have a quick look at the audit we've made and consider which do you feel like the highest priority debts, which feel like the most important to pay back or the ones most demanding of your attention right now.
Environmental.
Right.
But that could have just been the effect of today.
Yeah.
And then interpersonal.
Right. So it's the... Let's just check that there. It's the bigger effort, 80% more effort to the environment and 80 lentil grams of quality time to your parents. Is that
yes.
Right? Okay, so we're going to label those as red debts.
Okay.
Are there any of the remaining debts that just feel quite low priority to you at the moment?
The two financial ones can just tick along.
Yeah. So although those were the first you came in with, you do feel able to just let them be green light and green debts there. So actually these are feel more important to you. It's good to note. And these political debts here, would they be red, green or perhaps yellow?
There's a narrative around the Second World War in the UK that tells you that... that it was up to government to lead the way, that government had to bring a population kind of almost kicking and screaming to be prepared to act together in response to a crisis situation. But there's a really interesting alternative story can be told behind that. There's a fantastic book called Listening to Britain, which reproduces verbatim conversations that happened in Britain in 1940, because the government, wanting to know what the general mood was, spied on people, and they had people going out in every corner of the country reporting back weekly on what people were saying. And what those conversations revealed were that the general population were way ahead of government in terms of their preparedness for the war effort. There are phrases like, the willing horse is ready but it wants to be told what to do. Secondly, many of the solutions that were later rolled out by government came from the grassroots. So people were suggesting things in conversations which were then relayed back to government and spread through government propaganda. But the solutions came from the grassroots. And thirdly, that people weren't motivated to join into the war effort for British interests. A lot of those conversations revealed that people cared about the greater good. They cared about peace and stability across Europe. I mean, I think to me, if you look around Britain and the world today, actually most of the most innovative solutions that will help us respond to crises are coming from the grassroots level, whether you look at the transition town movement and the way that that spread like a form of social contagion, which involves people getting active around projects that they care about in their own community, whether it's growing food or changing education so that it is teaching children more about the ecology and caring for one another, whether that be around energy programmes, through to people standing as independents in elections in their local areas, through to projects like Incredible Edible in Todmorton, which spreading hugely quickly, which involved people just planting food in public spaces, through to protest movements like UK Uncut. So I think the future is already here, it's just not very evenly distributed.
So, it turned out right. Yes, it turned out right. In a few years, not so many years since that first sentence of yours. Words were losing common sense. Among shouts and whispers, you decided to write. It's still there, actually, but it's also everywhere. Who were you, and who were you writing to? Did you believe it then, that words still have the power to transform people? It was simple. Things went right. We did well. Let me tell you now, and briefly, my dearest stranger, how it went. Beginning. Societies gathered according to the will and desire of the people with a fundamental belief that the purpose of the economic system is to improve the well-being for all within the limits of what the planet can sustain. We had to deal with overconsumption first. The prices we paid for things had to reflect the social and environmental costs. Buying good things became cheaper and easier than buying bad things. And if things are really bad, we don't buy them at all. We took the collective and individual decision to be more self-sufficient and to produce more locally. And you know, because we're more content, having time for ourselves, friends and family, we also need less income for the false consumer's promise of buying happiness. We did very simple things. It was easy. The state promoted financial regulation, welfare policy, and reduced our carbon intensity. Even the very wealthiest agreed. Unequal societies are not just bad for people at the bottom end of the income distribution. They are bad for everyone and for every social domain. Remember, there is always a day in history when words become actions. That's why I'm writing to you. Because you must act now in order to transform my near future, so that one day someone I will never know will write to me sweet, inspiring words telling me I did something right.